Howard Shore.
It's true. There is no theme song for Saturday Night Live in the traditional sense. This is inherent in the nature of the show. I wanted the theme music for the show to have an improvisational feel like the show itself, and I wanted it to grow and change from year to year. And that's why, when I listen to the show now after 25, 26 years, it still sounds fresh to me and sort of classic, and it wouldn't have if you kept hearing the same hummable melody over and over. Because the nature of the music on the show was interplay between the 10 musicians, which is completely different than what you have in a big band or the Carson sound, which is very formalized arrangements written very specifically, and everybody plays what's written on the page. It's the same thing as the cast. You have to think of the musicians in the band the same as you think of the cast and how they would play off each other and kind of riff off each other. That was the same feeling I wanted to create in the music. So it had to have an improvisational nature. The saxophone was just a thing that I loved, and I am a saxophone player, so it was inherent in my soul that it be the predominant voice. Instead of a band playing a piece with a melody, it was an improvisation by a great blues soloist. On September 17, 1975, only a few weeks before the first live broadcast of what was then called NBC's Saturday Night, Lorne Michaels and several of his cast members got together in a rented Midtown studio for 45 minutes of screen tests to see how the performers looked on camera. Dan Aykroyd, Lorraine Newman, Gilda Radner, Chevy Chase, Garrett Morris, Bill Murray, token older actor George Coe, John Belushi, guest Andy Kaufman, and musical director Howard Shore took turns before the camera, most of them improvising material or summoning up routines they'd done in stage shows like the National Lampoon's, or at comedy clubs in the United States and Canada. The tape is a hot underground item but has never been shown on network television, though Michaels considered using parts of it in the 15th and 25th anniversary specials. What is Bill Murray doing there? Michaels had hoped to sign him for that first crop of not-ready-for-primetime players. But at nearly the last minute, he learned from NBC Bean Counters that the budget would not allow him to hire Murray, at least not now. He instead became a member of the repertory company known as the Primetime Players on Howard Cosell's short-lived ABC Saturday Night Variety Show. The tape shows the young performers at the tender and relatively innocent moment before they burst onto the American scene. Aykroyd, leading off, goes through a series of wacky riffs, starting with his recitation of mangled lyrics from the song Till There Was You from The Music Man. There were birds in the sky, but I never saw them winging till there was you. And you, of course, is the Mashimilov UT-1 rocket that Russia has just developed. In a Walter Cronkite voice, he reports on troop movements across the demilitarized zone into North Korea today, then does a mock commercial for Lloyd Manganaro deltoid spray, made from the extracted liquid from the spleens of perfumed sheep. Then he turns into a Louisiana swamp farmer who claims to have been briefly abducted by aliens in business suits. Now, you can believe it if you want to, or you can just say that I'm making up this story, but to me it was very, very important because it killed all the crabs in the area, and my livelihood is threatened, and I'd like somebody to do something about it. Then he assumes the voice of a man narrating a documentary and talks about shale and the influence of shale on the topography of the world, and how shale was superimposed and brought down by the glacial formations. This evolves into a discussion of glaciers, which ends with, "We have a lot of things to thank the glacier for, but who do we write to?" To off-screen director Dave Wilson in the control booth, Aykroyd asks obligingly, "More characters? More accents? Cleaner look?" But he's dismissed to be replaced in front of the camera by Lorraine Newman, who instantly becomes a chirpy and perky airline attendant. "Hi, my name is Sherry, and I was made to fly. When I was first thinking about becoming a stewardess, all my friends were really bugging me. They were coming up to me and saying things like, 'Well, God, Sherry, why do you want to be a stewardess, you know?' And I had to just sit down with myself and get super reflective and ask myself, 'Well, gosh, Sherry, why do you want to be a stewardess, you know?' And I really realized that it's because I love people. I really do. I love to serve 'em and try to help 'em fall asleep sitting up, you know?" Well, the real reason was I had to get out of the valley. I'm not kidding, man. It was really getting hairy. My boyfriend Brad and I were just falling apart. We had this really nice relationship. We were going to get married and everything, and like he installed stereo systems and customized fans, you know, and all he ever talked about was woofers and tweeters and push-pull rods, man. And it was really boring. It really grossed me out royal. And my relationship with his parents wasn't too cool either, because I wasn't Jewish, you know, and I like made a peach cobbler, and I heard them say, "Well, look, the shiksa made us a Presbyterian pie." Bill Murray follows, introducing himself as Washington Redskin Dwayne Thomas and saying, "You know, professional football has been good to me." He laments having been sentenced to 1-20 in Texas for possession of herb, then turns into interviewer Jerry Aldini, and soon is doing an early version of Nick, the awful lounge singer, a character that helped establish him, after some early audience resistance, as a true star on Saturday Night Live. First, he does a freewheeling version of the show tune, "Hey There," from The Pajama Game. "Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Nobody told you what day it was. Nobody was surprised." He pantomimes playing a cocktail piano, using the desk in front of him as a keyboard, threatening to sing and play something by Bobby Vinton, something from his new Polish Is Cool album. Gilda Radner, surprisingly, seems the least at ease in front of the camera. She giggles, looks off toward the wings where Lorne Michaels is standing. "I'm not going to talk about food," Gilda says. "I'm not going to talk about guys, so I don't have anything to say at all." She rambles for a few seconds, then asks, "Wait, can we get an audience in here?" Aykroyd, just out of camera range, tries to help by asking such questions as what Gilda would do if your period came on right now, then pretends to be Peter Marshall, host of the Hollywood Squares, and poses a question to Gilda. "Is it true that women accelerate more than men on expressway ramps?" Gilda, "Only if they're with a man." She offers to do her only character, Colleen, a clueless girl with the same goofy and faraway look no matter what the circumstances. Thus she looks exactly the same, blank and baffled, as she goes through a brief series of impressions. "This is Colleen at a Nureyev ballet. This is Colleen going to an Irish festival. This is Colleen having her first sexual experience." All are the same. Frustrated and restless, Gilda announces, "Lorne said if I just sat here and stared down the camera, it would take a lot of guts," then asks plaintively, "Can I go now, back to Toronto?" Lorne, off-camera, shouts, "Gilda, that was great!" Chevy Chase, in contrast to Gilda, looks supremely comfortable when he sits down in the chair and starts to talk. "You want me to do something here?" No member of the not-ready-for-primetime players, perhaps ever, has been more at home and less inhibited on camera. Ironic, considering that Chase originally wanted to be only a writer on the show. Immediately, Chevy becomes the fatuous anchorman he would immortalize in the weekend update segment of Saturday Night Live. He is holding a few sheets of paper and reads from them, or perhaps simply recites the material from memory. "Our final note concerns the birth of a baby sandpiper at the Washington Municipal Zoo this morning at 9:13. It's the first such birth in captivity on record. The chick weighed in at just under 14 grams, and it is said to resemble its mother quite closely. A final note of humor, the bird was stepped on and crushed to death by the baby hippo that was born on Wednesday." Said zookeeper John Pinkett, "Well, I guess I'll have to pour kerosene on the mother and light it and hope for the best. Later, perhaps, we can take an electric cattle prod and drive it into the ears of the baby hippo. Or perhaps shove a couple of cherry bombs up its ass, light them, and hope for the best. Well, that's the news this Wednesday. Good night, and have a pleasant tomorrow." Basically the same ending that would be used for Weekend Update once the show premiered. Chevy is asked to hold up a few of Edie Baskin's New York photographs so the camera can zoom in on them. Baskin's pictures will be used for a montage under the opening credits of Saturday Night Live. Originally, those credits featured only images of the city at night and no pictures of cast members. Jane Curtin, up next, performs what seems for her unusually sick material once she gets a mock commercial for Jamitol, Geritol, an iron supplement, out of the way. In show business, I've had a fairly limited career, she continues. It's hard to perform on stage in a wheelchair. However, I entertain a lot of people at my parents' family parties. Having a catheter, a lot of people think, is funny, and they like to see me dance. Thank you. A voice from the wings asks about what she does in the privacy of your own home, and Curtin replies, That's between me and my cat, isn't it? Murray steps into the frame and begins massaging her shoulders. Garrett Morris, who, like Chase, signed on only to be a writer, materializes next. As I have nothing prepared, I decided I might do some imitations, he says. The first imitation I will do is of James Mason. This is James Mason speaking. Morris makes only the most minimal effort to sound anything like James Mason. That's James Mason. Okay, I'll do another imitation. There's a guy named Cross-Eyed Jim that used to live on Federal Avenue in Marble City when I was a kid. Here is Cross-Eyed Jim. And he, of course, crosses his eyes. As a general West Indian, Morris talks about going to the second floor of Barney's and buying clothes from the Johnny Carson collection. Aykroyd comes in to feed Morris straight lines, asking him about having spent 10 minutes with an unnamed congressman. He asked me for a joint, Morris says, and I didn't have any on me. He usually gets a little high. The indictments against him haven't been proven yet, and I think we should give him the benefit of the doubt. Aykroyd, changing subjects. You're the man who saw the first mastodon come across the plains, am I correct? Morris. Yes, I did. I saw a mastodon. It wasn't across the plains, though. It was in my backyard, and it was sort of noisy. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, man. I just got in at 2:45, and I needed some rest. Told the mastodon left footprints 15 feet wide, Morris says, Geez, that was a big mother. John Belushi's turn before the camera that day was brief and very visual. And the instant Belushi sits down, he takes effortless command of the camera. He already has a compellingly dangerous look about him. Okay, he says. We're going to do some loosening up exercises. He practices doing takes and double takes, and then, as only Belushi could, some work on the eyebrows. He alternates left and right eyebrows, moving them up and down independently of each other in a series of eyebrow calisthenics. He shifts gears. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Saturday Night Show. The show is live, the show is not on tape, so all the mistakes you— He suddenly fakes a horrendous gagging sound, then regains his composure and continues. So all the mistakes happening on this show are real. We don't plan anything because everything is real. Now he breaks into a ghastly hacking cough, pretending to spit up into his hands. With tape, you have the advantage of editing things that don't work. With live television, anything goes. He attempts to attach strips of tissue to his eyelids, using spit to hold them on. Someone calls for an imitation of Marlon Brando, and Belushi does part of the taxicab scene from On the Waterfront. Don't you remember that night in the garden you came down and said, Kid, it ain't your night? Not my night. Charlie, it was you, Charlie. He grabs more tissue, stuffs it in his cheeks, and does Brando in The Godfather, followed by a quick impression of Rod Steiger. Teddy, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Don't talk to me that way! Finally, the definitively eccentric comic and performance artist Andy Kaufman, who will appear on the Saturday Night Live premiere, lip-syncing to the Mighty Mouse theme, sits in the chair looking incredibly young and bright-eyed, and simply recites the lyrics to MacArthur Park in a calm, conversational voice. Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh, no. He covers his eyes with his hands mournfully. When he finishes, the voice of director Dave Wilson comes over a loudspeaker. Andy, could you do that again, please? The same way? Exactly the same, if you can. And he does. The tape ends with music director Howard Shore, very much the scruffy hippie, modeling a pimpish-looking outfit for Lorne, who directs his movements from the wings. The Saturday Night Live cast was on the brink of success, poised to revolutionize television, looking fresh, brash, and golden. The premiere was less than a month away, October 11th, 1975, a date which will live in comedy. Brad Gray, manager. Bernie was there for the first dress rehearsal. He looked out and he saw the band rehearsing, and it was getting close to starting time. So he turned to Lorne, and he said, "Hey, Lorne, you know the band doesn't have their tuxedos on yet. Better get them into wardrobe." That always made me laugh, because it was so honest of Bernie. Tuxedos. And that's sort of, I guess, the merging of two generations. Dick Ebersol. Lorne's telling me every day that Chevy's got this great idea to open every show with a fall, and I am absolutely opposed. But Chevy was the only one who was funny and could write television for television. We were reading scripts in those early days where people would have a 3 or 4 minute sketch take place on 5 sets, and it didn't take a real scholar to know you couldn't do that if we were going to do a live television show in a box the size of 8H. Dave Wilson. Many of them had written for magazines or the National Lampoon Radio Hour or that kind of thing, so it wasn't as if they were brand new to writing. It's just that they weren't familiar with the medium of television. So, of course, we'd always go through things where you'd read their script and it says, "We start with a flooded studio." And you'd say, "Well, you better rethink that."
Jane Curtin. Before the show went on the air, we would all have to hang out on the 17th floor with the writers and pitch ideas and do all that kind of stuff. And Lorne would call us all into his office for whatever reason, and he would always end up by telling us what stars we were. And I'm thinking, hey, we haven't earned it yet. Not understanding the machine, the PR and all this stuff that was going to happen and that they were going to make happen. I think Lorne was trying to pump up the arrogance and the adrenaline in the room, which wasn't hard. And I understand now that in order to do that kind of a show, or any kind of a comedy show, you have to have arrogance, and you have to have adrenaline. And by telling people they're stars, maybe that's one way of doing that. But sadly, a couple of days later, I think some poor elevator operator was punched because he dared to ask someone in the cast for an ID. I just kept fighting that kind of thing. I just kept thinking, no, 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 no. It's just a TV show. It'll be okay, and I'm fine.
Billy Crystal, cast member. 3 months before the show was supposed to debut, Lorne had found me in a club called Catch a Rising Star. I went, "This is a television producer?" He sounded like David Steinberg, the comedian, because he was from Canada. He was very appealing, he was very smart, and he was funny in a different way than I envisioned television producers to be. He asked me if I was interested in being a resident in the company. He felt I would do 6 appearances on the show, and then he saw me becoming a host of the show, among all the other hosts, in 2 years. They'd be grooming me to be one of the main guys. That's how it came down prior to the show. Buddy Mora, manager. Billy turned down a Bill Cosby special, who was the hottest thing in the country at that time, to take Saturday Night Live, because they said, "If you do the Cosby Show, we're not interested in having you do this." And so we opted to do Saturday Night Live. We had agreed in advance for Billy to do his special piece on the first show, and that the piece required a certain amount of time. It wouldn't work in less time. So Billy was coming in every day from Long Island, and he just sat around all day long. They never spoke to him, they never got to him, they never said anything to him. He'd leave at the end of the day after spending 8 or 9 hours waiting around, and then come back the next morning again. This went on for pretty much the entire week. Billy Crystal. Then we get to Friday night. We had a run-through for a live audience and some NBC executives. Now, my routine was an audience participation piece, and it utilized Don Pardo, and it was this African safari thing with sound effects. I played Victor Mature. It's not going to sound funny. Walking across the camp in Africa to knock the tarantula spider off Rita Hayworth's chest. So that was the setup. Don Pardo, who we never saw on camera, had his hands in a big bowl of potato chips, and every time I took a step, Don would crunch the potato chips, so it was like this whole sound effects thing. It was really funny on Friday night, and it ran 6.5 minutes, because it took a long time to explain it. But there were laughs in the explanation, and then the piece just sort of went on its own. And Friday night, it was the comedy highlight of the night, and I thought, I'm in great shape here. George Carlin's hosting this new show, and I knew everybody in the show, and this is going to be sensational. Lorne sent in notes after the Friday night run-through, and he said to me, I need 2 minutes. And I said, cut 2 minutes? And he said, no, I need 2 minutes. All you get is 2 minutes. So it was a drastic cut in the piece. And frankly, as a new performer then, I didn't have a little hunk like Andy Kaufman's Mighty Mouse. I didn't have a 2-minute thing that I could plug into the show. And I didn't have a stand-up piece that felt like what the show should be that I could have scored in 2 or 3 minutes. So we had a big dilemma. And after being involved with Lorne and the show for so long, we were all kind of confused as to what to do. And then when we saw the rundown, they had put me on at 5-1. The last 5 minutes of the show. How can you score? This wasn't what we had talked about. So my representative said they were going to come in on Saturday and talk to Lorne.
Barbara Gallagher. Lorne said to me, we have to cut Billy after dress rehearsal. Why don't you go tell Buddy? I said, me? Me tell Buddy? What, are you crazy? He said, yeah, you've got to tell him. Lorne didn't like confrontation. He hated it. So I went and told Buddy. I said, I think it's a mistake. I know Lorne feels terrible that he has to do this. I said, Buddy, don't kill the messenger. I love Billy.
Lorne Michaels. Buddy was a strong advocate for Billy, and I think what I objected to was him telling me what I should cut, as opposed to just making the pro-Billy case. He made the who was funnier case, which was not a good thing to do. He said I should cut Andy Kaufman. I probably didn't have the nerve to cut Carlin. One, he was our host, and two, he'd lent his name to the show, which was, at the time, a big deal. I think Andy, because he was surreal and there was nothing else like him on the show, had the edge. Albert had submitted his first film, which was 13 minutes long. Fortunately, he also submitted his second one, which was a lot shorter, and that was the one we ran. I thought Billy was really funny, or else I wouldn't have put him on the show. But I also thought that he was the one thing we could hold, the one thing we had the most of, stand-up comedy, because of Carlin. Buddy turned everything into high drama. It became very heated. Buddy Mora. We took him off the show Saturday because they weren't living up to what we had agreed to. Jack Rollins and I decided if we couldn't get what we were promised early on, we would take Billy off the show. Earlier in the week, I had said just that to Barbara Gallagher, who was the associate producer. The piece was supposed to run about 6 minutes or 5.5 minutes, and it just wouldn't work in any less time. You could shave a few seconds off, but that would be about it. Lorne Michaels. Buddy had no idea what was going on. I don't think Bernie did either. They were from another time of show business. We were eating vegetables, they were eating donuts. It was a different world. We were much more like a crusade. It was a very passionate group of people. Billy was sort of one of us, but now suddenly it went into this other kind of mode. The talk with Buddy was of another time, and it made Billy not one of us. And I think that was unfortunate for all of us, because he had been. Billy Crystal. I was waiting in the lobby with Gilda for the dress rehearsal to take place at 8 o'clock while my managers talked to Lorne. We had asked for 5 minutes in the first hour, which, given what we had been through with Lorne in the preparations, didn't seem like an outlandish request. About 7 o'clock, my manager, Buddy Mora, and Jack Rollins came out and suddenly said, "Okay, we're going, that's it." I said, "What happened?" They said, "Lorne went, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't promise anything." So Buddy said, "We're going to go, there's no time, you're being bumped, and that's it." I had my makeup on. Gilda got all upset and angry. I was totally confused about the whole thing. Buddy Mora. It comes down to a matter of what they thought was most important. I know how bad Billy felt for a long time. I'm talking about several years after that. It still always bothered him. And it bothered me, too. We walked out of NBC that night, and I can tell you my stomach was not in great shape, and it wasn't for several days after that. It wasn't an easy thing to do, but we felt it was the right thing to do. Billy Crystal. I was upset. Mad, I guess, because I had wanted to be there. I was mad at my own managers because I wanted to do the show. And I didn't want it to look like I was the guy who stormed off the show. That wasn't the truth. But my managers were protecting me. And Lorne was protecting his show, which I respect. Lorne Michaels. We were all under enormous pressure. None of us had done this before. It was a big night for an enormous number of people, Billy included. To be cut was, I'm sure, terribly hurtful for Billy, but there was no implication at all that it was about his not being good enough or of not wanting him on the show. This was straight confrontation. It was Buddy, it wasn't Billy.
Barbara Gallagher. It was a mistake when you look back on it. Billy was hysterical during dress. Very funny.
Billy Crystal. I was friendly with John, and especially with Gilda. They were always confused and blamed my managers. Especially John, he used to say, "They screwed you, man." And then after that, things weren't great for me for a while. I felt bad. I did come back the next year when Ron Nessen hosted the show, and I did a routine, and that was great. But after that, there was 8 years when I didn't do the show. Bernie Brillstein. 5 minutes before the first show, I came through the back door where the food and coffee was, and there was Belushi, sitting on a bench with Craig Kellum, who was the associate producer, and Craig was saying, "John, you've just got to sign your contract. NBC won't allow you on the air until you do." And I just happened to walk by at the time, and I didn't really know John well at all. I couldn't believe NBC and its stupidity was pressuring him at such a time. So John said to me, "Should I sign this contract?" And I said, "Of course you should sign this contract." He said, "Why?" I said, "Because I wrote it," which, by the way, wasn't true, but I knew I had to get him to sign it. He said, "Okay, I'll sign the contract if you manage me." I swear to God, it was 5 minutes before showtime. Belushi knew I managed Lorne, so why shouldn't he be managed by the same guy who's managing the boss, right? At that time, I didn't know how great Belushi was, so I just said yes to get him to sign the goddamned contract. It worked out great, and he turned out, obviously, to be one of my best friends. Tom Schiller. Before the offices on 17 were filled up with furniture and stuff, I somehow got the key and went up there one night, and I was still enough of a hippie or a spiritual person that I lit a candle in each office as a sort of general mantra or prayer that the show would be successful and that it wouldn't hurt anybody. So at least that part came true. And then on the first night of the show, still in my hippie phase, I went to every point underneath the bleachers and every point around the studio to try and send out good vibrations to the home viewing audience, knowing we were sending out a signal across the ether that would be received all across the country. I wanted us to be sending it out with good wishes. Herb Sargent, writer. The very first night of the show, between dress and air, Chevy and I went down and had a cup of coffee at Hurley's bar downstairs. And Chevy said, "What's going to happen to me?" Because it was a big moment, you know, for all those people. He says, "Where am I going to go from here?" I said, "You'll probably end up hosting a talk show." I was kidding. But it's strange, you know. He wasn't frightened, but he was very curious. And it was like an empty vista out there. The interesting part of that for me is that even before the first live show, he was already thinking about what the next step was. Neil Levy. There was a feeling even before it started that something important was happening. It was almost like all the leftover spirit of the 60s found its way into this show. That spirit of rebellion, of breaking through whatever boundaries were left, There was something so special about being there that you knew from the moment you got there that this was going to work. Of course, some writers weren't so sure. Even Dan Aykroyd, he had a bag all packed. He said, "Neil, this show could fold in a second, and I got a nice little spot picked out on the 401, and I'm going to open a truck stop." He had a whole plan. Craig Kellum. We almost didn't get on the air because dress rehearsal went so poorly. I remember Lorne seriously asking the network people, or having me ask them, to have a movie ready to go just in case, and I don't think he was kidding. George Carlin was the host when the show, still called NBC's Saturday Night, premiered on October 11, 1975. Only about two-thirds of NBC's affiliated stations carried the show, which had received very little advance publicity from the network. Over the course of its 90 minutes, Carlin, stoned out of his mind, according to observers, delivered 3 separate comedy monologues, probably 2 too many. Iconoclastic comic Andy Kaufman lip-synced the Mighty Mouse theme song, a seminal and now legendary moment. There were also several numbers by musical guests Janis Ian and Billy Preston, an appearance from a new group of adult Muppets invented for the show by Jim Henson, and a short film by Albert Brooks. The Not Ready for Primetime Players, so named by writer Herb Sargent because Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell over on ABC at 8 p.m. had a small comedy ensemble known as the Primetime Players, one of whom was Bill Murray, actually appeared very little on that first night. When they did, they were dressed as bees. The young performers were supplemented by an older Broadway actor named George Coe, who helped with narrations and commercial parodies and stayed around for one season only. The format was more like that of a traditional variety show, with nearly as much music as comedy, and the repertory players there as laugh insurance, even filler. Among the consistent elements from the beginning was the cold open prior to veteran announcer Don Pardo's recitation of the bill of fare and the opening credits. Many a modern movie had started this way, with a grabber or teaser scene prior to the credits, but it was something new for a TV show. The very first cold open was new, too. An absurdist encounter between bad boy writer Michael O'Donohue, playing a teacher of English, and bad boy actor John Belushi as a semi-literate immigrant who repeats everything O'Donohue says, including, "I would like to feed your fingertips to the Wolverines." When O'Donohue suddenly keels over with a heart attack, Belushi's character dutifully does the same, falling to the floor. Thus did John Belushi feign death within the first 3 minutes of the very first show. Then Chevy Chase, as the floor manager, wearing a headset and carrying a clipboard, sticks his head in, sees the seemingly dead bodies, smiles broadly in that phony television way, and says, for the first of more than 500 times that it would be said in years to come, "Live from New York, it's Saturday night." Lorne Michaels. I made the decision Thursday to open cold with Wolverines. It seemed to me that whatever else happened, there would never have been anything like this on television. No one would know what kind of show this is from seeing that.
Edie Baskin, photographer. For the title sequence, I just went around and photographed New York at night. Actually, the first titles had no pictures of the cast, only pictures of New York. Lorne had loved some pictures I'd done of Las Vegas and some of my other work, which was very different for that time.
Lorne Michaels. The major focus of the night, weirdly enough, was over a directive we got that Carlin had to wear a suit on the show. He wanted to wear a T-shirt. The directive came from Dave Tebbett. He was head of talent and very supportive of the show, but he was also trying to anticipate. The fear was that if George was in a T-shirt and it looked like the wrong kind of show, we would lose affiliates, and we weren't anywhere near 100% as it was. And the compromise was a suit with a T-shirt instead of a tie. That was a much greater distraction than can possibly be understood right now. Craig Kellum. Tebbett was the Don Corleone of network executives. And at that time I didn't look all that good. People dressed pretty sloppily there. And I went up and Tebbit was reading the riot act about the prerequisites for Carlin's performance. And they included, he's going to have to get his hair cut and have it look neat. And he went through this whole diatribe about what Carlin was not going to do, and it was uncomfortably close to the way I looked in the office. He went through the list, suit, tie, hair, and then he looks down at my bare ankles and says, socks! Dick Ebersol. If you go back and look at the first show on the air, the two people by far who had the most to do on the show were Chevy and Jane. There were only 4 or 5 sketches. The rest of it was 4 songs, 6 monologues, 3 by Carlin, 1 by Andy Kaufman, his Mighty Mouse bit, and 1 by What's-Her-Face, a comedian who ended up in the show instead of Billy Crystal, Valerie Bromfeld from Canada.
Rosie Schuster. We were buzzed. I don't think we had any clue what kind of phenomenon was going to happen. Carlin later confessed that he was pretty loaded. Andy Kaufman was on that show. There were a lot of featured guests. There wasn't a lot of comedy on that show. But there was the live buzz you just got from that studio audience, and it was pretty upbeat. I think everybody knew there had to be a lot more comedy sketches, and that the cast had to be used more.
Lorne Michaels. I taught at an art school in Toronto. I was teaching improvisations, the conceptual art movement which was being talked about and on the edge of things in the early 70s. Where that and entertainment met was what Andy Kaufman was doing. It wasn't just that he lip-synced to Mighty Mouse. It was that he only did that one part in it, that one line, and stood around for the rest. It was very conceptual, and it instantly signaled to the brighter part of the audience that that was the kind of show we were going to do. And they weren't getting that anywhere else on television. In the first couple years, Andy must have been on close to 10 times. One night, he even read from The Great Gatsby. In the beginning, I had Penn and Teller on a few times, because that was the DNA, but I couldn't do that now. The pure variety show part of it is over. It's a straight comedy show now. Steve Martin, host. I do remember when I first saw the show. I was living in Aspen, and it came on, and I thought, they've done it. They did the zeitgeist. They did what was out there, what we all had in our heads, this kind of new comedy. And I thought, well, someone's done it on television now. I didn't know Lorne at the time. I didn't know anyone. Herbert Schlosser. I can remember the first time I saw it. I was in Boston, staying at the Ritz for the Cincinnati Red Sox World Series, and I had been with Bowie Kuhn. You always sit with the commissioner if you're president of the company. That was a truly great World Series. We had dinner, and I asked if he'd like to see a new show we were putting on. And that was the first show in October of 1975, with George Carlin. Neither of us knew what to expect. Now, Bowie's a nice man, but very straight-laced, very proper, and a religious man. I sat on a chair, and he and his wife sat on the couch. He didn't laugh, and I thought, well, that's Bowie. And then after a while, he started to chuckle, and then he'd actually laugh. And I figured, well, if he likes it, it's going to have a wider audience than most people think. Al Franken. I felt very confident that the show was going to work. It was youthful arrogance, I guess. I looked around and I thought, this has never been on TV before, and this will work, this should work, and of course it's going to be a hit, which is an attitude I've never actually had since. Lorne Michaels. The only note we got from the network on the first show was, cut the bees. And so I made sure to put them in the next show. I had them come out and talk to Paul Simon. He says, it didn't work last week, it's cut. And they go, oh, and just walk off.